Hello, and welcome to Plot Trysts. This is Meg. Today's episode is part of our limited series, My Word is Vorkosigan. These episodes deviate a bit from our regular Plot Trysts format. I'm not hosting them with Lane, but rather with historical romance author and fellow Lois McMaster Bujold superfan Alexandra Vasti. Instead of short, digestible book reviews, these episodes are longer discussions of each book in the Vorkosigan Saga series, and do involve major spoilers. If you're reading along with us, please feel free to join our Discord discussion. You can find an invitation link at our website, plottrysts.wordpress.com, or at the link in our Instagram bio, at plottrysts. Today's episode features Brothers in Arms with guest host Olivia Waite. Olivia is a historical romance author, the New York Times romance fiction columnist, and yet another Bujold superfan. Enjoy! Hello, and welcome back to another episode of My Word is Vorkosigan, a special series on Plot Trysts. As always, I am Meg, and I'm joined by my co-hostess, Alexandra Vasti.
Hello, I'm Alexandra Vasti, and I write romance novels.
And we also have a very special guest today. We have Olivia Waite with us. So, hello, Olivia.
Hello, I'm Olivia Waite. I write historical romance, sci-fi, and fantasy, and I'm also the romance columnist, New York Times Book Review.
So, which is fancy. Yes, we have very good guests on the show. Like, I'm not kidding. When Alex and I were putting this together, we were like, do you think maybe we could get Olivia Waite? And she came.
Yeah, Olivia, maybe? Which, yeah, so we're super excited. We're both huge fans. Yeah, I think we've both read like everything you've ever read.
Just about, yeah.
Seriously. So,
yeah, maybe.
Big fans. So thank you so much for joining us. We're very excited to have you and excited that you too are a Vorkosigan fan. I was trying to make some kind of portmanteau, but it didn't really work. Vorkosa fan.
Vorkosa fan?
Yeah.
Oh, I like that actually. But today we're going to be talking about Brothers in Arms, which is an amazing book. I mean, they're all really amazing. And this book was published in 1989.
So,
wow. Yeah, very interestingly, it's like one of the earlier ones that she wrote in the series, but mm-hmm. that falls, I always feel like it falls a little bit, this is sort of like a change for Miles, right? But yeah. So anyway, mm-hmm. just always interesting to see when she published the book.
Yeah, let me do our quick plot summary.
Yes, and when it was written. So, all right, Alex, I'll turn it over to you.
Yeah. All right. So this one happens pretty much immediately after the last novella of Birds of Infinity. So it's right after the sort of Dagula 4 rescue disaster situation. And the Sea Gandons have put a hit on Admiral Naismith. And so they sort of have taken a lot of damage. They need some money. So they sort of retire to Earth. So this is our first book set on Earth, Old Planet Earth, which I love. And so we have Miles and the Dondarri are sort of stopped there. Miles goes to the Barry Yaren embassy because he needs money. The Dondarri are completely out of money. You know, they need the repairs. They need to pay their people, et cetera. So he meets his captain, Dove Glenny, who is his superior. And Glenny is a Komarin. And so there's this, obviously, this tension that we have had between Beriar and Komar, given that Beriar is the conqueror, the imperial power who has taken over Komar. And this is doubly so affecting because obviously Miles is a Vorkosigan, the son of the butcher of Komar. So they have this kind of very fraught relationship, which is that Glenny thinks that, you know, Miles is sort of a Nepo baby, but he has to keep him safe because Glenny is one of the new Komarins in the Beriar and imperial service. So he's part of this new integration movement. So he wants to sort of keep his nose clean, definitely doesn't want Miles to like get assassinated. That would be very bad for PR. And so he kind of confines Miles to quarters in as they wait for this money. And things keep happening with the money. You know, it doesn't come in. The messages aren't getting passed correctly. It's sort of a money problems. So Miles is keeping his identity as Admiral Naismith a complete secret. You know, the Sea Gandons are after Naismith, etc. The Sea Gandon embassy is like right across the street. And so, but Miles has to sneak out one day because there's sort of a problem. Daenerys mercenaries, like a few of them have gone rogue and sort of like taken over a wine shop and are holding it hostage. And Miles is like, oh gee, this is really embarrassing. So he like runs down there, resolve the problem. He ends up sort of in a burst of flames, saving the woman who runs the wine shop, and he gets caught on news cameras. This becomes a problem when he is at a Beren Yaren event in his Miles Vorkosigan, you know, Lord Vorkosigan persona, and he is confronted by a reporter who says, oh, no, Admiral Nesmith, what are you doing here in a Beren Yaren uniform? You know, so he comes up with a story sort of off the top of his head that he has a clone, that Admiral Nesmith is his clone. And he says the story so convincingly that even the reporter is taken in as Miles is, you know, able to do so. So then Miles ends up kind of there going back and forth. There's some issues with trying to get the money, and they get a potential contract for Admiral Nesmith to kidnap Lord Miles Vorkosigan. And of course, Miles is sort of tickled by this. Everyone's like, clearly, you know, it's a trap, right? And he's like, I know, but I need to spring the trap and I need to find out who it is and what's going on. So they go to this kidnapping. And Miles does get kidnapped and is replaced by an actual clone. And so, of course, Miles is like, what? You know, I thought I made this story up. It's very funny. It's just so great. So he gets replaced by an actual clone. The clone, it turns out, is a Qumaran creation. And this Qumaran rebel patriot has created this clone to get back at Aerol Vorkosigan, and has these sort of like multi-layered plots which involve, you know, having Aerol Vorkosigan assassinated by his own son and whatnot. Miles is abducted. He ends up, Galeni is also abducted there with him, and it turns out that this Qumaran patriot rebel fellow is actually Galeni's father, who is sort of believed to be dead, but clearly is not, has been sort of like creating this plot over the last many years. And he had hoped to get his son on his side, to get his son to turn against the Beren Yaren, but, you know, so far Dove has refused to do so. So meanwhile, the clone, the unnamed clone at this point, you know, is off trying to play Admiral Nesmith. Miles has a conversation with the clone. He sort of comes to this knowledge that, like, the clone is his brother, right? Under Baden law, like, the clone is his twin brother. He tells him, you have a name, you know, your name would be Mark Pierre Vorkos again. He tries to sort of suborn the clone, but is unsuccessful. Galeni and Miles get free. They sort of think things are going well, but then the bad dad, whose name is Galen, Sir Galen, kidnaps Ivan. I don't think I've even mentioned Ivan, but Ivan's been there this whole time. and so Miles and Ellie and Galeni go to try to rescue Ivan. In the sort of crisis, the clone kills Sir Galen. Miles tries to sort of be like, come with us, you know, we want to, you know, you can be my brother, but the clone is way too sort of fearful and skeptical and paranoid. So he kind of runs off and that's the end. And fortunately, you know, Miles is finally able to get his money, and the and the Dendari are able to finally depart. All right, I think I got it. I think that's pretty much the story.
That's about it. It's a lot.
Yep. Yeah, it's a busy book.
Time I'm giving the summaries, I'm like, wow, a lot happened. And every book is like this. I mean, they are plot dense books.
They are.
They really are. But yeah. So Olivia, what made you choose this book? So I know that this might not have been your first choice, but this, you did have a choice of a lot of books by Lois.
Yes. Yeah. So, and this is one of my favorite ones to reread from the series. And partly because, as a romance author, if there's anything we know, it's that the things you take, the lies you try to live become the truth eventually. And so when Miles learns that this whole, like, I have a clone, it's a brilliant lie. And then, of course, he literally has a clone. And it's a big moment for the series, Mark, for the first time. It's just, it's such a great moment that he has this, what he thought was this flash of inspiration. And of course, it's because he saw Mark briefly, like at a train station. Right. And so it was like planted in his head. So just that hideous, sickening, oh my God, I do have a clone. This is actually terrible. It was fun when I got to be myself and the clone. And it's kind of feeding into Miles through all of these, especially the early books. He has this desire to try to live as many lives as he can. He wants to be as many people as he can. Like, he thinks that I think on some level, he thinks that Miles Vorkosigan is a disappointment to his family. Mm-hmm. And so Admiral Naismith is obviously a glory hound and a bon vivant and all of those like terrifying things. And so Miles enjoys inhabiting him, doesn't want to go back to being Vorkosigan. And then in Brothers in Arms, he had for a brief moment, he thinks, I get to be both. He'd love to kidnap himself. It's a very Miles kind of plot. And then so to come up with the to like confront the fact that no, there is another
inhabiting
this persona already. There is a clone. He's a real person. You have to deal with this.
Right.
I think that's a big shock for Miles, even before he gets like, you know, kind of cashiered out of the mercenaries.
Oh, absolutely. Alex, I know you wanted to.
No, I was just going to say the scene where he is talking, like he thinks he has this revelation of the clone is so, so hilarious to me because he is like the way he starts, like he comes up with this idea of the clone and then he starts talking about Naismith, right? And so I'm looking at the quotes. The biological construct who calls himself Admiral Naismith is perhaps the most dangerous man in the galaxy. Cunning, resolute, you know, he's done this. He's like, you know, he's whatever. And he's like, that's the genius and the wonder of the man, cried Miles, then decided he better tone it down a bit. Like, he's so
it's a praise himself. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Yeah. It's, absolutely.
It's really absolutely. Delightful.
Yeah. He's like, this is great. Like, I can raise Admiral Naismith's profile. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But this book also sets up this whole arc of Miles and Mark, right? So this is like really incredible because
which is like the next three books, four books, like minimum.
I mean, I think it's really fascinating for me anyway. It throughout the series, we've got this whole idea of like parenting and family being really important, and then we've just got this clone who gets thrown in there, and there's this entire part, Alex, I know you pointed it out, about like just what is Mark's relationship with all of these different people.
Yeah.
Right. So immediately Miles is like, okay, well, if I was a Baton, he would be my son. But if in this place, he would be my brother. And in this place, Sir Galen is his father. But that means that Galeni is his brother. And like, just like all of these family relationships that to me is just really, what I love about Bujold is that she really thinks of each character as a person. And then their relationships with everyone else. So I don't know. I think that's
And in this world, like family politics are imperial politics.
Yes.
Because we're so close to, you know, the center of the empire, like relationship wise. I know, like, you know, Miles and Ivan are always anxious about being in the line of succession. And so when you talk about family relationships, it's not just, oh my God, I have a brother, the way that ordinary people would be surprised by. It's like, oh my God, there's another pretender to the throne kind of always lurking behind it. And that's part of Ser Galen's kind of plan, right? Is he's going to assassinate Errol and then the emperor, and then eventually the clone will sit on the Beriarn imperial throne. Ha ha ha! Ser Galen, question mark? I don't know. It's a terrible idea. It's a terrible, terrible plan.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think this is, Alex, you have pointed out that this is kind of, if we're talking about like character based and like character, like really character forward science fiction, Sir Galen is very much a caricature.
Yeah.
And this is something that I think we'll probably talk more to about when we get to say Komar, for example, because I mean, I think that this, like the Komarans are the conquered people, like the Beriarans are the oppressor here. And theoretically, I think the Komaran side is very sympathetic, right? I think the Komarian patriots and Komaran rebels are in some ways on the right side of history. And so to see the, you know, the representative of the Komaran here be kind of a cartoonish villain, I think is not maybe the best like political moment for me of the series. However, I think Bujold is going to give us a lot more sort of complexity and depth with that in Komar.
Well, and it's complicated by the fact that Komar tried to be the oppressors to Beriar with the whole Sudagandan invasion. And Komar's clearly like, but again, it's like if you're pinched between two superpowers, like, what are you supposed to do? What was Komar supposed to do against Sudaganda?
Right, like, exactly.
Like they're right, this tiny terraformed planet. Yeah.
Right.
But it is disappointing because it like, it risks coming down on the side of, well, the way to be a good colonized person is to assimilate into the empire that's colonized you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the whole problem with Dove Galeni, is that how much is he supposed to be a role model and how much is he supposed to be an individual making the best choices he can?
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that I actually really love about this one is the way that Dove gets kidnapped is he goes out to lunch with his father. He agrees to lunch with his father and he doesn't report it to the Barryon embassy. Like, this is him again. We've got this family relationship and Miles never condemns him for that. And I think it's a really nice part of the book, you know?
Yeah. So, well, and I think that's an important basis for the trust that they build going forward, which is again, the personal relationships become the foundation for the like political movements of the empire. That because Miles and Dove have this kind of trauma bond in this book, that they're able to work together later in Imperial Security or Imperial IMPSEC. Is it Imperial Security? Yeah.
You got it.
I think you're exactly right. And I think that Miles is so sympathetic to this incredibly difficult position that Dove is in, right? Because so after things sort of start to resolve, Galen, the dad, Sir Galen, and the clone are still free. And so the Barryaran people are like, well, do we need to hunt them down? We should kill them. We should take them back to Barryar for a trial, you know? And Miles is like very anxious and stressed about this because he knows that that's Dove's dad, right? And then of course Dove has seen all of his family like lost to the violence on both sides in the Barryar and Comaran conflict. And Miles doesn't want that for him, right? And Miles thinks, you know, what do you do when all choices are bad, right? He's like, what do we do? What are we going to do in this situation? And Miles is constantly trying to kind of come up with a way out of this problem where he's like, what is there some way that Dove can keep his honor, can keep his position, but also can, you know, cannot like have to see his dad like, you know, killed horribly or something. And you know, ultimately Mark, the clone, takes that out of their hands by killing, you know, Galen that's for a very different set of crimes, right? Like Mark is adjudicating the problem for what Galen has done to Mark, not to the Empire.
Exactly. So like the personal crimes versus the political crimes and how the personal and the political levels are always kind of bleeding back and forth in this book. They do in the series more broadly, but I think in this book it really like they really kind of screw it home. Like when Miles is concerned about Dove's relationship with his father, how much of that is a reflection of Miles knowing that his own father's political reputation is vastly exaggerated and that there's always secrets behind, like the whole Butcher of Comar thing is like we're never entirely clear. There's a slight chance that Errol did it, but everything we know about Errol is like, no, he would never. Like, we have seen this man at his absolute worst, and that is not an order he would give. But it's impossible to explain that if you're not the reader who's seen all of Errol making these decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And so, how much of what Miles is feeling for Dove is projection, and Miles imagining what he would feel in that situation? And it makes good political strategy, but it's also a very deeply personal reaction. And it's so.
Yeah, and I think too. Yeah. That projection goes both ways, right? Because one of the things that Sir Galen is saying in their sort of final confrontation is like, why? He's like, okay, like, you know, you're this like, you know, clearly like Barryar, he's talking to Miles, he's like, Barryar has had all these horrible impacts on you, right? Like, look at your little, you know, stunted little body, whatever. He's like, why haven't you turned against Barryar, right? And then he's like, what did Errol say to you that made you want to follow him, right? Like, he's evil, he's a monster. And it's so interesting because he's, you know, clearly he's so angry about the fact that Miles is loyal to his father when his own son isn't loyal to him, right? And he doesn't say that, but it's clear that mirror between those two father-son relationships is like, he's so angry about that personal thing on top of all the political layers.
Well, and then we have the whole fact that Sir Galen obviously doesn't consider Mark to be his son, and he has done all of the same things to him that Barryar has done to Miles, and then he's somehow surprised at the end when Mark is not.
I think that conversation is part of what makes up Mark's mind, is he's thinking about like, look at what Barryar has done to you, look at all, and Mark's sitting there kind of listening.
Mm-hmm.
It's like,
I've never thought about it that way. Yeah, you're so right.
Yeah, that it's not Miles's persuasion in this case, that it's secretly like Sir Galen's own arguments that Mark is primed to listen to from years and years and years of abuse.
Yes. Yeah. Let's talk about Mark, because
oh God, poor Mark.
Yeah. And we don't get his viewpoint in this book. Like, he's
very much like a monster kind of figure.
Exactly.
Like Frankenstein's monster in particular.
Yeah, exactly. So Mark is cloned. They somehow got some of Miles's genes.
He's been aimed.
Yes.
And is it Miles who brings up the fact that they must have been so surprised when he grows up, like, looking normal?
Yes.
That's one of the first things that Miles thinks, right? He's like, he, in fact, he's having a conversation. He's like, he must be some kind of surgical construct. He's like, he can't be a clone because a clone of me would look like Ivan, right? This is like one of the foundational parts of Miles' self-conception, right? Is that
secretly I look like Ivan.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, how many times do you hear it's not genetic, it's teratogenic. Like, it's just repeated. Yeah. And when he realizes that Mark is his clone, he's like, what did they do to you? Like,
yeah. And he's horrified.
Yeah.
Right. He's horrified.
It's like one thing to be like, well, this was a failed assassination attempt. Things went wrong. Nobody meant to do this. Obviously, they meant to kill somebody, which is terrible, but like, nobody meant me to live like this. I was not meant to live like this. Somebody meant Mark to live like that.
And he knows, he has been through all of these surgical procedures. He knows exactly how painful and terrible it is. And and at least for him, it was trying to help him, right? To make him as, physically capable.
Like the bone replacements, it's like, great. He's not going to shatter all the time.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But for Mark, the point is to make him, smaller, right? He's just like so well positioned to see Mark and know exactly what's been done to him and exactly how terrible that is. It's what's happened.
And I love that the relationship he ultimately chooses to try and persuade Mark with is brothers. That it's not, because he could have gone with, on Beta Colony, I would be your father, etc. And he could have there could have been something really weird and interesting that Bujold could have set up, but she specifically had Miles choose brothers. That it's an equal relationship, that it's consanguinity, that we are the same, we are like connected, but not in a position of one authority over the other.
Right. Yeah. I mean, to me, one of the most moving and heartbreaking moments is when Miles is talking to Mark and he's throwing all his darts, right? Trying to figure out what's going to affect it. He's being very Miles. But then he's thinking to himself, he thinks something like, I keep telling him the truth and I don't mean to, right? He keeps giving, little flashes of what he wants, which is he wants a brother, right? He wants a family.
He wants a sibling really badly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's a part two at the end of the book where he thinks about the fact that, I think that's in this book, where there's a lot of these books, where he thinks about the fact that he has no siblings. And that's because, is that in this one? I don't know. Meg will know.
But it's somewhere close. Yeah.
Yeah. Where he thinks about the fact that the reason that they never had, that Cordelia and Errol never had any more children, is because they never, ever wanted, him to feel like he wasn't good enough. If they had another child who was, looked like Ivan, right? There would be a push for in Beriar, body conscious Beriar, to say, oh, that should be the heir. That child should be the heir, right? And so they never, ever wanted him to think that he wasn't good enough for them. So that's why they chose never to have any children. And he feels guilty and feels this longing and yearning for a sibling.
Well, and he knows his mother would have loved to have seven kids.
Right. Yes. Yes.
I love how counterintuitive that is for Cordelia, but she basically wants her own little survey ship crew, I think.
Her biological empire, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yes. But the
Meg, is that in this book where he thinks about the fact that his parents never had more kids? Is that in this? That's in this.
Yes.
One, right?
Yes. He because he's like, oh, this kind of takes it out of my hands. He's like, oh, I've always felt guilty that they didn't have it. So it's like this guilt that obviously Cordelia would never want to lay on him, but he knows that she wants more kids. And I think that leads to there's that line in this book where Ivan is like, why are you being nice to him, basically? And nice to Mark. And Miles is like, well, I can just hear my mother's voice saying, Miles, what did you do with your baby brother?
And Cordelia really is the way out of the trap in this case. Like, fathers and sons are messy. Fathers and sons are complicated. Fathers and sons are going to get you killed, either because your empire is your father and you have to sacrifice for it, or your father, or you're going to lose your father to the empire and have to take his place. Like,
yeah, right.
Relationship with paternity is always one of loss in these books. Like, partly because, you know, Errol Vorkosigan is always off serving the empire, and he sacrificed so much for his career and for his family, but also because in order to come into your own as a Beriaran aristocrat, your father has to die.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, right. It's sort of like a historical romance. Like, why people are always like, well, why are the Duke's dads always dead? Like, the,
because
then it wouldn't be a little
bit. Because they have to be. I know.
But Cordelia, like the mother, and the mother from a different planet with different mindsets and different ways of approaching things, she gives Miles that escape hatch in like so many instances. And she does here, like, Miles, what have you done to your baby brother? It is so perfect. And it's such a good moral compass for Miles in this.
Yeah.
And it saves his life several times over, ultimately.
Absolutely.
And I think that, you know, Mark is never going to believe that, like, Errol Vorkosigan might be his dad, right? Like, just because of the way that Errol Vorkosigan has been built up in his mind and the stories and the mythologies. But Sir Gawain forgot about Cordelia. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Mark, do we know anything about...
She wasn't really mentioned in my training.
Yeah, like Sir Gawain doesn't really think about mothers, like, at all. Like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Weird way in which Mark is supposed to replace his own... But, like, do we hear about his wife? Is she just, like, kind of some dead sacrificial figure?
She died. Yeah, she died. Yeah, we're told that she died, like, when, like, pretty early on, I think. But she doesn't seem to have, like, played a major role in
right.
Her. Yeah, so it's not in his experience, and so he just doesn't think about it. He doesn't think about mothers.
And everybody underestimates Cordelia on Beriar, right? Like, they're like, oh, like, she's just the countess. She's just whatever, right? They don't see how important and significant and powerful she is.
Did they forget about the head? Because none of us forgot about the head.
Forget about the head.
And Miles never forgets about the head. Like, that's his running joke. He's like, my mom should take you shopping. And it's like, no.
Oh, I know. I love it. I never get over that.
But I think that then when Miles is trying to convince Mark, Cordelia becomes a way in, because Mark doesn't have that sort of built up picture of what the Countess Vorkosigan like would be like, and Mark and Miles is like, you know, she's Baden, she wouldn't accept you as your son immediately, immediately that's how she would see you, you know, and I think that's something that Mark has never thought about before, and it's just like all the little sort of like ways that Miles connects with him, that's one of the most effective. And then telling him he has a name, right, when he realizes that Galen calls Mark Miles, and he's like, he's never had his own name.
Yeah.
He's like, that is messed up.
And then does Mark later think of himself as like Miles Mark II? Like, that's kind of how he shortens it in his head.
Someone calls him Miles Mark II, but I forget. I think that's Ivan.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Ivan Wood.
This was a good book for Ivan, I felt like. We always talk about, we're always like, and this is where Ivan is more than just a character. And this is where Ivan, and I think we've said that about like every book now. Like, we're like always like, well, look, Ivan, but everybody pay attention to Ivan because we love Ivan so much. But he's really a good character in this one. Like, when he is, like, he's trapped and he's just like constantly like going to the mat for Miles in this one when he really doesn't have to.
Well, I remember when I was first reading the series, this is the book where I got to where I was like, oh, Miles actually cares about Ivan. Because I feel like in other books, like, Ivan is there and he's like kind of comic relief and Miles can kind of count on him, but he's always discounted as a someone that he really cares about, at least for me. And I mean, again, we're talking about like Warrior's Apprentice and Seed of Ganda, right?
I think of them as being very close in Seed of Ganda. Like, they bicker, but it's a very sibling kind of bickering to me.
But here it's like Ivan is very much, I don't know, there's when Ivan is in peril, then yeah. Miles is like, I really need to go save him. Like, he's my brother. Like, we are close. And that's to me when I was like, oh, like there's a real bond. Like, before, I don't know. This one is the one for me where I see it.
Yeah.
No, yeah, I agree with you. Very heart-wrenching when Miles is like, we have to find Ivan. Where is Ivan? You know, he's like, I mean, it's like, of course, like you knew that Miles was going to go save Ivan, but like, it's really very, I feel like we really feel that emotional, like the emotional depth of their connection for me. In yes. This one. I agree, Meg.
Yeah.
Well, and he's just coming out of like, Miles is also just coming out of the prison camp and he's got all the mercenaries with him, but Ivan's always a connection home.
Mm.
Like there's always like, he can always trust Ivan. He can always trust Ivan for help. He can always like, he's a relative, but he's also a friend, but he's also like, you know, often a military attaché. And it's such a convenient character role for so many different reasons. It's like thematically, but also emotionally, like you say. And it is really moving. We've come to know Ivan, even yeah. though like he is a himbo, but he's clearly like, this is also kind of the point in the series where you're starting to realize Ivan's not as dumb as he pretends. Like he really like, he wants to be like the young spark about town, but he also knows that's a great way to stay out of power. And that's a great mm-hmm. way to be like avoided as a political target.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. But, and like there's a part where Miles thinks like he recognized that this is Ivan playing dumb to get other people to do the thinking, right? Like Ivan has like yeah. thought of something, but he doesn't want to be the one to say it. So he just kind of like, whatever.
He just kind of shepherds the conversation. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think we're realizing that. Miles is realizing that at the same time, you know?
Well, because Ivan had to have been learning something when Miles was out doing mercenary right. stuff. Right. What Ivan learned was, you know, verbal chicanery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, no, he's also good at his job, which I think...
Very good at his job, yeah.
Yeah, which I don't think you realize, you know?
There's like this part
where it's like, they joke about him, like, squiring all of these, like, elderly yeah. dowagers around, but the yes. elderly dowagers will know everything, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, there's also a part, though, where you know, he gets into the embassy, and he's supposed to be, like, Ivan's assistant, basically, and Miles is like, Ivan, you can be done with this by noon. Like, you could, you, and Ivan's like, I know, but then it would give me more work. He's like, why would I want that? Why? But it's like so antithetical to everything about Miles, like everything Miles stands for.
Well, Miles is always trying to like live past the expectations for him, and Ivan is very much aware that those same expectations would make him like a contender for the throne, and he doesn't want to challenge Gregor because he's young, aristocratic, attractive in the proper gender and in like a properly abled body, and he's like, oh no, that's a greased slide down the track and I don't want it. And so he has to like underperform to try and slow that process down.
Well, and I mean, we really do see the difference because Miles has been complaining for books and books and books, oh, the reward for a job well done is another job, and Ivan is like, yeah, I know, that's why I'm just do this one.
Yeah,
you know?
That's why yeah. we're taking it slow on the paperwork this morning.
Yeah, right. It's like, slow it down, rein it in.
Oh, man. I wish I could be more like Ivan, because I'm definitely like Miles. Like, we could do this by noon. Come on. Come on, people.
Have we talked right, about we haven't talked Ellie? About
Ellie at all. And... Can we talk about Ellie? Because this is
there
like, yeah, this is like some real romance in this book. I'm personally very yeah. excited about this.
Oh, poor Ellie. She breaks my heart a little. Like she's crazy about Naismith, but she can't even really like mentally access Miles. Like there's this whole other side of him that he kind of deliberately keeps hidden because he doesn't want to think about it. And so Ellie's in love with him insofar as she knows him. But every time they brush up against Beriar again, it's like this gap opens up between them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, when she meets Miles, Lord Miles, she's like, "This, who is this? Like, what is this? This is not, yeah. I don't like this.
No, I don't like this. Yeah. I don't like any of it." She doesn't like, I mean, she's right not to like Beriar. She's making the opposite choice Cordelia made, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And partly that's...
Yeah. I've thought about that a lot, actually, because... It's like Miles is sort of like maybe Oedipally a little bit like looking for someone to do what his mother did, right? To pick him so much that they're willing to take on Beriar, right? And Elena wouldn't do it. You know, Elena, I mean, I don't think Elena was totally in love with him anyway, but I think Elena certainly cared about him, but she was like, absolutely not. Like, there's no way I would ever want to be Lady Vorkos again. And Ellie is the same, right? She really does love him. But again, she's like, there, you know, I love you and I do not love Beriar and I would not, you know, give myself away to enough to go not be Ellie and be Lady Vorkos again. And it's like he is searching for someone to do what Cordelia did and he can't find it, at least, you know, not yet.
No, and like the question is, does Ekaterin actually make the same choice Cordelia does? Like, or how is it different? Because obviously she is from Beriar, so it's a different kind of choice. So for her, what she's choosing is to go back, I guess, to flash a little forward. Ekaterin eventually chooses Miles over, like, she chooses to walk right back into that giant steel cage of a Beriarin marriage, of a Beriarin aristocratic marriage that she knows from the inside can go horribly, horribly wrong.
Yeah, and I do wonder, like, what galactic woman would choose Beriar? Like, Cordelia is a special case because...
Well, Cordelia is special because Errol is also special. And, like, Miles is special, but it's, like...
I mean, even later in the series, even Ellie is like, look, if it was Errol, I would think about it.
Well, yeah, but that's because Errol is, like, he's such a complete person. He's himself at every level at all times. And partly that's because he's had to, like, he's kind of... You know how Damascus steel is like made? That you have layers, you make layers of steel and then you fold them over and over and squash them like a croissant, like that's that lamination. And so it's the same term, lamination. And so what you get is these very, very complex, very strong layers of metal folded over each other, one after the other. And it has this like, the look of it's incredible and it's rippled and it's colorful and it's super, super strong. But that's how I feel that Errol is he has all these different sides to him because he's a spectacularly charismatic person. But through the trauma of like the whole civil war and like the overthrow of the Cetagandan Empire and everything that followed, all of his layers of personality have been compressed and forged into like a complex and beautiful whole. Whereas Miles has like facets more like a gemstone, so he flashes different sides of himself at people, but they find it hard to see to the center.
Yeah,
and it tends to make him brilliant, but it also tends to make him feel fickle or changeable in a way that solid steely Errol never would. Like Errol, you can tune a compass to, and Miles, God help you if you tried.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I think it's so interesting that you were like, Errol is a full complete person and Miles is like two full complete people, right? Yes. Like,
yeah, he's always trying to be somebody at least else.
Two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At least two, yeah.
No, but you're so right that Ellie does not know anything about the Vorkosigan side of him. She even, like, when the first time she hears him speak with a Beriarin accent, she's like, you know, it's weird to hear you do his accent. And he's like, no, he does mine. And he's like, wait, that's not quite what I meant. You know, and I think that this book is very elegant in setting us up for like Miles's own kind of like internal struggle with his multiple personas, which is going to take books and books to resolve, right? That it is going to be a long time before he is able to kind of unify himself in a way. And I think that I don't know exactly what I think. Like, I just think that Miles could never become himself on Beriar, so he has to invent this other persona to kind of try to contain and direct all of this energy that he has that Beriar just would not let him use.
No, right? Beriar would want to keep him like kind of a prisoner in this one body and this one definition of a body. And as soon as he gets off planet, whole entire worlds open up.
Absolutely. And so what galactic woman would want to go to Beriar, right? Because a female body is also a prison on Beriar.
He really has, you know, the wrong examples in Cordelia, and then what, his grandmother, right? Who was Baton as well, right? So, or great grandmother, Errol's grandmother. So he's like, of course, they all want to come to Beriar.
And it's like, sweetie, no, they really don't.
Yeah, no.
They look at it and they're like, oh, actually give live birth? No, thank you. Yeah.
Right.
I also think there's this interesting part about Ellie and Miles. This is when Miles decides, like consciously decides, that he's going to break his rule about fraternization, right? Mm-hmm. Because before he was like, I'm not going to do it with Tora. Like, we saw Tora, but she hadn't, you know, enlisted yet. And so,
she wasn't part of his team yet. It's fine.
Right, right. And he even is like, oh, well, she's not part of the team yet. And once you do join them, it's like, we're going to break it off. But then in this one, he's like, well, you know what? I'm gonna slide a little, you know,
he's just coming off of the whole events in Dagula 4 where he was stripped down to basically literally nothing and lost somebody he cared about. And it's like, you can tell he has a new awareness of time running short.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think it's just interesting too for the series, the long arc of the series, that we can sort of see this moment here where he's like, oh, okay, I'm gonna give a little.
Well, and like, who else is going to understand him? If not on Beriar, then it must be in the mercenaries, right? Because he can't, they're the ones he can be the most honest with for a certain value of honesty. Right. And even when he's inventing like Naismith, he chooses his mother's maiden name. Like, really? Nobody connects this. None of the Sea to Gandan, like, intelligence services make this connection on day one.
That's why the clone identity is just so smart, you know?
Well, exactly. Yeah. It's beautiful, and it's just unfortunate that it's true.
You're right, I know. It's so beautiful. It's so elegant, you know? It's so funny. The part where he sees, because he's had these little, like, things in his head where he's sort of gotten confused, like, about, like, when he's talking to Galenia and he's trying to get the money, and he's, and, you know, they're kind of sniping at each other, and Galenia is talking about, you know, it's after he goes and fixes the wine shop debacle, and he's like, well, I had to be Admiral Naismith in that moment. And Glennie's like, well, you're not, you know, there is no Admiral Naismith. And he's like, well, you expect me to play the role of Lieutenant Vorkosigan? And Glennie's like, you are Lieutenant Vorkosigan, but you play the role. And so Miles is kind of very, like, I think, like, sort of anxious and feeling sort of unsettled in himself about who he is and his identities. So then when he sees the clone for the first time, it's just like this incredible, like, shock to his system of like,
this is a role somebody could play, somebody can step into this space. Yeah. And I think the essential draggy nature of it kind of helps him paradoxically. Like, thinking of Lieutenant Vorkosigan as a role he can play helps him approach it in a way that doesn't make him feel less than for not living up to it. If that makes sense. Like, Naismith is absolutely a kind of drag. Cordelia, as Errol's wife, is absolutely playing it as a role, like, the entire time. She's not, that's why she, like, consistently puzzles everybody, and she's like, oh, but my job as a galactic wife of this high-ranking Beriar is to puzzle everybody. They will write off any eccentricity. I can do what I want within this, like, kind of protected space.
Mm-hmm.
And she uses that mostly to protect other people, because of course she does, she's Cordelia. But this sense that Miles has of Lieutenant Vorkosigan, of this spot on Beriar as, like, a looming location in his future, like, it's the long dark tunnel he's eventually going to have to walk down, is, I love how kind of sinister it is. And as soon as he realizes he doesn't have to make that journey alone, that he has a brother, he latches onto it so quick.
Mm-hmm.
And I think too, though, I mean, he is reminded repeatedly that he doesn't have to do this, right? He's Admiral Naismith. He could take the Dondarri and trot away, and, you know, maybe Beriar would eventually hunt them down, but maybe they wouldn't. Like, he's Errol's son. They might just sort of, like, quietly let him, you know, go off and be Admiral Naismith.
But he could never, he could never go visit his mother again. Like,
right?
He could never see Gregor. He could never see Beriar.
He loves Beriar. He does love Beriar. Fucked up and a mess, and I think that's something there's something for me, like, maybe because I live in a place that's fucked up and a mess, but, like, there's something very relatable about loving your home and knowing what a mess it is, and knowing you know that it has so many problems, and yet, like, you feel that commitment and love and care for it.
It's a very complex kind of love, and it's like family. You can't design your family. You have to love them as they are, whether you're born with them or whether you find them later. You have to love your family as they are, or it doesn't count somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And obviously when family members betray you, you then get to make the choice about
what. And that's part of too why I think it's interesting, like that, just the interesting characterization of Mark, because sorry, I think I had a little audio lag. Go ahead.
Yeah, you're saying characterization of Mark.
Yeah, okay, so I think that the characterization of Mark is really interesting too, because he is kind of mysterious in this one, right? And Miles is trying to figure out Mark a little bit so that he can, as you say, like, love him for who he is. But he keeps thinking about, when he's thinking about Mark, he's thinking about himself, right? He's like, what was I doing when I was 17? You know, oh, he must be smart like me. And we don't have, you know, we don't have Mark in this one yet. We don't have Mark as like a real whole person. We know that he's smart, that he's crafty, that he's fearful and paranoid, but we don't know really him yet. So I think that's why it's such a just like glorious, you know, thing in the next book that we do get his POV.
Yeah. Right. Well, this is very much like the Frankenstein version. Like, I think it's not a coincidence that we're in London where Mary Shelley was writing. Well, she wasn't. I mean, she was, yeah. Obviously she was. Frankenstein first in Switzerland, whole famous thing, but this idea of like the monster confronting its creator and not knowing what's going on in the monster's mind, and this whole series of trauma, and how do you deal with a creature that you've made now that it's blaming you for having made it? What is your moral responsibility? What's your emotional state? And yeah, we haven't even touched on the fact that this is the first glimpse we've gotten of old Earth. And so this is the first time in the series that we've had a reference for how to understand a place outside of what Bujold is telling us. And so it's this really interesting lens where we're constantly kind of like touching in what's different, what's changed. And so that whole like the Thames tidal barrier.
Well, the whole part where she says like London is now a seaside town.
Yeah.
Right. Like, and we need these barriers to keep it from being flooded at high tide. Like, it's fascinating. She's obviously thought about it, you know, it's just like, wow.
Right. There's all there's like the overhead view with all the docks and locks and everything.
No, it's really, it's really interesting.
I was just rereading this week because I'm currently writing a little, which by the time this episode comes out, we have released Into the Wild months ago, but right now I'm writing it, a book which is like partially set in the Thames estuary, and there's like a whole section with like the tides are coming in, and I was like, oh my god, I wasn't even thinking about Brothers in Arms when I was writing this book, but obviously it was just like lingering there in my subconscious, like the title Thames.
Yeah.
And that's going to be exciting, because we don't see enough of that in historical romance, I don't think. Like, more London estuaries. Like, I think some of Sarah McLean's are on the docks, but like, I don't know. I want messier than that. Sarah McLean's always end up rich and titled, and I want people who stay on the docks.
Well, I can tell you that this is no one has a title. Everyone is just regular people in this one. So it's there.
There's so much interesting regular people in the Regency, like, and Victorian eras. It's so much weirder than historical romance usually lets it be.
Yeah. Yeah. I do like books that let it get weird, which I think, to bring it back to Bujold will dive straight in to like letting things be weird and just really goes quite dark, not so much in this one, maybe like somewhat with Galen. I mean, it does go pretty dark with Galen, but especially in the next book. I mean, the next book with Mark
is like capital M messed up.
So if you listeners are reading along with us, prepare yourselves for the next
book. Check all the trigger warnings for the next one.
Yes. Like, you get to be in Mark's head, and it is a dark place.
Yeah, it's like terrible things happen in the book.
Terrible things happen.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a tough one.
So Memory, what's the next title? There's Memory is the one with Simon Illion, but that's not the next book.
Mirror Dance is the next one.
Mirror Dance, yes. Oh, geez. So many terrible decisions in that book.
Oh my gosh. And me too. Just Bujold to set us up for some big falls. All right. Yeah. Let's.
I mean, you read this one and it's like a farce, right? Oh, clone farce. Yeah, oh, this is funny. Fun. Yeah. Ha, ha, ha. But she's like, oh, let's really think about this, guys.
Yes. You're so right. She controls tone so impressively, right? She has books that are just like pure romps, and but yet she's constantly like laying the groundwork for the really dark, you know, heavier books to come. And she's just a genius, really. All right, that's way. We always end on she's a genius, so I'm saying it. All right, let's talk about wider Borcosaverse references in this one.
Yes. So. I mean, we're bringing it back to Komar. So we have a lot of Komaran references. We've got Errol as the Butcher of Komar, which I don't think we've thought of for a while in the series.
Right. And we're like actually let that vanish.
Yeah, we're actually meeting people who lived through those times too.
Yeah, exactly. Like we have had the Butcher of Komar story from Errol, you know, from Errol's perspective, and now like we're really she didn't just sort of like throw that in as like some little like haha Errol backstory. Like it's really affected the world building.
Yeah. It's still affecting like the decisions people make and the political atmosphere that Errol has to be hyper conscious of all the moves he makes, and the fact that it's him trying to bring Komarans into the service. That there's a sense he's trying to make some kind of public atonement. Yes. By saying, no, you're a part of the Empire now. You are siblings like all of our other, like all of our Beriaran citizens.
Public atonement, but also in Ariel's mind, I think it's about the people. It's, you know what I mean? It's about the people that this will affect and the opportunities that this will open up for regular Komarans.
Yeah.
We have Miles at one point thinks, I think we were talking about this, but Miles thinks, what do you choose when all choices are bad? Which is almost a direct quote of Errol in Charge of Honor. He says, what do you choose when all choices are evil? Right. So that's really, I think that's part of Bujold's kind of like core story, is that she loves to put her characters in this these impossible ethical positions, and then they try to fight their way out.
Yeah. And then we've already talked about this as well, but this is all happening right after Dagula 4. And so we're seeing those effects on Miles.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's a very, quite a dark book as well. And I think we see that trauma playing out. I mean, he doesn't just get over it.
Right.
No, he's lost people before, but never quite like that.
Yes. Right. Yes. Absolutely.
And then this is the first book where, oh, I'm sorry, Alex. This is the first book where we see Miles and his idiosyncratic reaction to Fast Penta. So we have not seen him get Fast Penta yet, right? And it's amazing. It's just wonderful.
It's super fun, yeah.
It's so
funny. The motor mouth, like the uncontrollable motor mouth it's on character and it's also hilarious, honestly. Yeah.
It's he's like after the interrogation, and he's like, he's still having the effects. Like, they can't even give him the antagonist, poor Miles. No, he's like back in his cell, leaping up on the cot and like delivering the parts and doing the voices.
And poor Galeni, because he's got to sit through it
all
night. And he's finally like, okay, is the play over? Are you done?
Miles, oh my goodness. I would not want to be locked in a cell with Miles.
God, no.
No, Fast Penta or not.
Would you, because like you're almost certainly getting out at some point.
That's a good point.
If only because they want you gone.
Right. Death is the only way out.
Maybe you do want to be in a cell with Miles. I don't know.
I don't know. How expendable am I? Like. Yeah.
Am I more or less expendable than Miles? All right, so we also have in this one, Miles buys Ellie the Living Fur, which will crop up again sort of quite comically in some later books one book.
And there is also a reference. Miles talks about how he could sell them all radioactive farmland, which, as we all know, he's done before.
Done before. It's super funny. All right. And so lastly, let's talk about the title, which is Brothers in Arms, which I think is a really good, like, kind of multi-layered Bujold sort of type of title.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, I mean, you've got Miles and his clone, the brothers, but you've also got not just the military implications of, like, you know, Band of Brothers type thing, but the sense that shared service is what brings people together, and that you have, like, Komar and Beriar are trying to achieve this resolution after years of conflict.
Absolutely. And
yeah, you have to struggle against things together in order to achieve a solid relationship.
Yeah. I've okay. always, so I actually always mix this title up because, so it's Brothers in Arms, but I always think maybe it's Brothers at Arms because, so there's always this kind of like implicit play of words, I think, right? Because so like, are they together against the world or are they against each other, right?
So. Right. And this is also, I think, the first book where Miles really reflects on the fact that to some extent, Ivan is like a brother to him yeah. and that they have that brotherly relationship. Mm-hmm. And we really see him feeling like that emotional connection as well. I yeah. also think that there's something interesting, too, about there are several times where the Beriarans don't take the Dendari female officers seriously as yeah. Soldiers. And so I think that there's some sort of interesting kind of like gender play there that they are
Miles
women
confronted. And,
yeah right, but they're confronted by this gender prejudice right. that they, you know, normally have to deal with in, or hopefully not too much in the Dendari.
Yeah,
so there's that,
right.
that level too.
Yeah
Well, Olivia, thank you so much for joining us.
An absolute delight.
I was had a great time. I mean, I've had a great time every episode, but like this was really, really fun.
Yes, thank you so much. And this episode will be coming out in April, so I don't know if there's anything that you want to mention, but where can readers find you? What should they be looking out for in 2024?
The best place to find me is on my website. That's oliviawaite.com. And that will be all whatever social media I'm using in April. Who knows? You'll be able to find it there. There'll be a newsletter sign up and any latest announcements. There are some things coming down the pipe that I cannot talk about yet, but I do not have any more details.
We'll be very excited to hear more.
I know
Meg and I will be on the front lines ready to.
Well, it's going to be exciting. Some of it is I finally get to flex my sci-fi muscles, which I haven't gotten to do professionally like ever, I don't think.
Well, that's
it's
very
so
exciting.
Much fun, because I've been a sci-fi and fantasy reader as long as I've been a romance reader. And so I finally get to like break some of that stuff out, which is so fun. So it's very exciting. Hopefully by April, I will be able to talk about some of this. So if you're hearing this in April, you can run right over to the website and learn all the secrets right now. No waiting at all.
And Alex, where can they find you?
Also on my website, alexandravasti.com, or on Instagram or TikTok, which is just at alexandravasti. And looking forward to my debut novel coming out in the next couple months.
Yay! And you can find me at plottrists on Instagram or at plottrists.wordpress.com. And we will talk to you next time.